Welcome, everybody, to today's Clue and Internet Seminar, which is entitled NARPM Presents In Situ Sediment Remediation Using Benthic Water Jet Amendment Placement. Again, I'm going to ask if you're on the phone lines to go ahead and mute your phone. You basically can use your own mute button or hit *6 to mute your line. My name is Jean Valance, and I'll be helping to moderate today's Clue and Seminar, coming from the same office that helped sponsor today's event, which is part of the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. I'm just going to cover a few housekeeping items before we kick things off. And as a reminder, with today's Clue-In Seminar, you'll need to have a copy of the PowerPoint presentations open or available to you so that you can be verbally guided through those materials by our presenter today. So if you haven't done so already, you want to be sure to either download a copy as either PDF or PowerPoint, or actually go to the seminar homepage and click on the button that appears on the left side that says Go to Seminar. You can look at the slides in a web browser window. If you don't have that information in either the confirmation messages or reminder emails you received, the seminar homepage or URL is the location that you can actually find or download copies of these materials. On that homepage, you'll find a description of today's session, as well as contact information for both myself and our presenter today. And then, again, those links to either go to the seminar or download the slides. So by now, everybody should be looking at slide number one, which is the title slide for today's session, and I'm going to ask everybody to move along to slide number two. If you have an electronic copy or a PDF version, simply click to the next page. If you're looking at the slides online, you can use the numbered links that appear to the left of the slides, or use the icons that appear in orange buttons at the top. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow to the left will move you backwards one slide. Again, this is a reminder for those of you who are listening to us by phone, please place the call on mute. I've been able to hear some side conversations or office activity. So again, you'll want to be sure to use your own mute button. If you don't have a mute button, hit *6. At the time for Q&A that we have allotted, you'll be welcome to take yourself off of mute at that time by using the *6 or using your own unmute button. I'll remind everybody about that when we get to the Q&A session. But until then, please be very helpful if you could go ahead and keep yourself on mute. Also, don't put the call on hold. There could be background music or commercials that will be disruptive. If you do need to, you are certainly welcome to hang up on the phone line. There won't be any disruption to us, and you can call back in as soon as you're ready to continue your participation. A reminder, again, we will have time for Q&A with our instructor. If you're on the phone lines, you'll be invited to take yourself off of mute and actually ask your questions out loud. But for those of you who are streaming the audio, you'll want to use that question mark icon that appears at the top of your slides in the web browser window. As long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, if you click that question mark button, a new window will open up where you can actually type your comment or question. We would encourage you to go ahead and submit comments and questions as soon as they occur to you. You don't need to wait until the designated period. Just know that we won't be reading those questions out loud to be answered until we get to our designated point for questions and answers. So go ahead and start typing them in as soon as they occur to you. But we may wait until we get to the appropriate point before we read and answer them. A final reminder to everybody, today's session is being recorded. It takes about 1 to 2 weeks to archive the event, and at that time you'll receive an automatic email from me letting you know where you can download or replay the session for free online. You can also sign up for the Clue-In podcast to receive the archive sessions as soon as they're available. And that URL, again, where you can access our free archive of over 400 Clue-In Internet seminars is shown on slide number two. So with that, and one last reminder and request to have everybody go ahead out and keep their phone lines on mute, I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number three, which is the official begin of our presentation today. And I'm going to turn it over to Joel Birkin, who's a professor from the Missouri University of Science and Technology. And Joel, whenever you're ready to begin, please do so.
Great. Thanks, everybody, for joining in today. I hope everybody can hear me okay. I'm sitting in my office from lovely Rolla, Missouri, and I think it's a great thing that Clue-In does to do this. I want to offer a great big thanks to Gene for setting this up, Jody McCarty, and Rob Weber for helping to organize this and making this all possible to bring this here today. So within that, we'll go through the title slide here, and we'll be talking about in-situ sediment remediation, as stated, with a benthic water jet. And we're going to be looking at amendment placement within that, and we're going to be covering laboratory studies that are getting to the small pilot scale at this point. But we're still actually looking for opportunities to get to the field and apply this. I am at the Missouri University of Science and Technology, and for folks that have been around a while, the name has not. We're formerly Missouri University and Rawa, UMR. And we had a name change a while ago, so if the name seems familiar or unfamiliar, that's why. So moving along, I first want to acknowledge all my coworkers and co-authors on this. Really, the initial idea started with Kurt Elmore and I when we were visiting the water jet laboratories in Raleigh here. And Greg Galecki and Dave Summers are professors in the water jet area, actually in mining engineering. And then you see the list of students going from Aaron Archer, Gavin Risley, Chris Riddell, Ryan Stringer, and Grace Harper, who have done most of the work you're going to see here today. And when we started working in the sediment field overall and looking at some of the techniques we were using, Danny Reibel was very generous to join our group and has offered a lot to get us going. And this work was all funded by NIH, NIEHS, through the projects listed there. So with full credit to them, and a lot of the work has been put up on their website and such as well. So, and there's a number of present or publications that I could send to people that are listed throughout. And all, again, all this work was NIH funded. So moving on to the introduction slide, I think it's very well known if you're on this call that there's a wide range of contaminated sites and the sediment load is tremendous within our country that's contaminated and growing every day. We're finding more and more sites. What we'll talk about today is focusing on PAH compounds, just in the methodologies we're using. But as far as the delivery mechanism of the water jets, we feel it could be applied to a number of other compounds, too. And when we're looking for new solutions and improvements, we really need to look at what capabilities we have. And really, the current solution that we're looking at are capping in situ and dredging, as far as what has been applied on a large scale. So we're looking at new approaches to go along with those or in place of those in some cases. So what we're focusing on in this talk was the idea of injecting or delivering activated carbon to reduce the bioavailability, and again in this study for PAHs, but also applicable to PCBs and other hydrophobic compounds. So what we're considering is that we do not destroy the compounds with this technology, but hold them in place, but reduce the capability for them to transfer into biologic organisms or into the water column. And the real advantage of what we're looking at overall, we can move on to the next slide, is the idea that we can deliver them in place and reduce resuspension, but also target specific levels of contamination. So you can see on the left a very precise water jet that we have in our water jet lab, which is widely used for anything from hard rock mining. They've designed water or rock cutting heads using water jets. They do precision metal cutting with the water jets, even more precise than lasers because we don't have the heat issue. And they do a lot of work on disarming or disposing of munitions, and they've even applied the water jets at our laboratory in surgery. So with those capabilities, we looked at the ability to take a fairly dense slurry, including amendments or solids, and the idea that we could inject those into sediments and target the profile we're looking at, and thereby reducing the amount of amendment we need to put in, reducing mixing of the sediment, and really one of the big areas we're looking at is reducing the benthic impacts and also the resuspension. And what we're really considering here could look at any amendment as we're working through the bullet points at the bottom. And with that, as new amendments are being generated, be it a biologic amendment, a chemical amendment, or even a stabilization issue, we feel that the water jets we're developing can apply those to a number of different settings. So moving on to the next slide, which is the fifth slide in my presentation, what we're focusing on within our placement right now is a liquid amendment, activated carbon, or zero-valent iron, Fe0 listed there. We have done a lot of work with Fe0, but given the time limitations, we're not going to present that today. And what we want to quantify then at the end is a reduction in the contaminant resuspension versus other methods, and also do we reduce the benthic mortality that we would expect. So those are our objectives, and we'll move on to if we've accomplished those and see what we're doing. The preliminary work we've looked at, we've done liquid slurry amendments with a pulse injection, and we've also done a continuous flow. Some of the solid amendments with the iron that we had were troublesome is that the concentrations we were shooting for plugged the essentially state-of-the-art systems that we were using and called back pressure and some packing amendments, so we had to come up with some new technology there. We used a pneumatic delivery system along with the hydraulic injection. And then when we test the sediments, what we're looking for is, do we minimize resuspension and also minimize the surface disturbance, and we measure that as an impact to the benthic community. Moving on to the next slide, which is the seventh myth, and we're going to move quickly through the next one. So we're looking at the pulse injection you can see here. So it can do a small pulse, and I'm just going to walk through these, and it essentially plays like a movie. I was kind of concerned that the movie might not work. So if we go slide one, move forward, slide two, you see the pocket forming where the water that's displacing it essentially delivers the amendment, which is the liquid in this case, showing as a green dye, into a non-cohesive silica sand in this case. And as we move forward, you can see the pocket of delivery continues to expand, and the void pocket above it is essentially where the water is being placed that's going along with the amendment. And if we move to the next one, you can see the injection lance has moved forward and started the second injection, and the pocket has yet to collapse from the first. And as we move forward, you can see the pocket of the first one collapses. It does result in some resuspension from that injection, but the second injection is starting to place it. So overall, we're looking to try, and with a pulse injection, to do a number of placements at fairly discrete levels and discrete points. But if we understand how those spread in the subsurface, we can target a certain area. And if we move forward one more, you can see how the pocket is forming and the placement is continuing. And that essentially is how the pulse injection works. So now we're moving on to the next one, and this should say granular amendment delivery method one. And this is the only slide I have on essentially our first methodology within this. I've presented on this previously and wanted to at least convey what we're doing. So in this case, you can see the first window with the A, B, and C portions of that. And A is essentially a nozzle we designed. They can bring together the hydraulic amendment, or in this case, the hydraulic fluid is acting as a cutter, and then the side valve there brings in pneumatic feed, where we suspend the iron particles, zero valent iron or ZVI, in a pneumatic feed, and then the pneumatic feed and the hydraulic feed are brought together in the nozzle, and we put them through what you see as nozzle C there, that then focuses or disperses the flow as needed. So the single blast method does a good job at pressure dissipation within the system. However, the negative of that that appeared in a publication earlier was that the pneumatic energy really leads to a lot of resuspension that we didn't want to have. It's still less than a lot of the mechanical methods, but there's just a lot of energy that has to be dissipated, and it's dissipated in resuspension. So the constant flow nozzle that you see down at the bottom there is a dual nozzle system that we've designed. And two nozzles essentially counter cross, and the distance between where they cross and the angle and how far they're above the surface let us control how deep we want to put the amendment and how much spread we get in the subsurface. Moving forward to slide 14 amongst the slides I put in, we'll talk about some of the experiments we've done with the positive displacement method, and that's the type of pump that you would like. And in this case, we used a pulse injection, and it was started at 2,500 PSI and then stabilized at about 700 PSI after the valve was released and continued for 5 to 7 seconds. Flow rate used in the study is given there along with the nozzle dimensions and the slurry that we utilized. We're able to push carbon slurries up to about 20% carbon, but anything above 15% is noted here really can become problematic within the valving. And within, essentially, if we have a stop flow, we can get a little bit of a kind of a water hammer effect that tends to make the particles pack together. So we like to stay below about 15%. And I think it's important to know we don't have any suspension agent in this also. We've gone higher if we suspend with a guar or some type of other suspension agent, but to minimize essentially the impact and make it as simplistic as possible, we really try to stay without the suspension agent. The test bed we're using in what I'm presenting today is a fully saturated kaolinite, and we use this as our cohesive sediment, and we use a surrogate sediment in this case, so we can actually monitor placement visually and with quantifiable optic methods also. So in this case, if we use a real sediment with black, we can't see where our carbon is placed. And if we're trying to do a lot of studies to understand how the placement occurred, it really becomes prohibitive to do any analysis on chemically where the carbon is placed. So what you'll see is kaolinite or a silica white sand where the carbon has been placed into that, and then we can optically determine concentrations and dispersion. So what you see in the next slide then is 54 shots taken on a one inch increment. And we'll move forward to that. And in the upper right window, you can see how that carbon placement is at depth. So we did it in a basically a 1 foot diameter cylinder, and you see the publication listed there at the bottom. And on an average concentration at depth of 20 centimeters below the surface, we could get up to about a 3.4%. And that's what we were targeting. We certainly could go higher with a longer length injection, but you will see from the image that we do get pockets of placement where there's high concentration and then also small areas in between. And the concept within that is that over time, the chemical activity across that profile would be normalized out, and we measured the benthic impacts also. And I will say at this point that while the kaolinite clay is really pretty necessary so we can do these optical dispersion measurements, it's not ideal and does not behave quite like the sediment. When we go to sediment studies in just a little bit, we do see a lot more even distribution because the particle-particle interactions are just so strong in the kaolinite, it's hard to get mixing like we get in the actual sediment. And you see one of the publications listed at the bottom there where you can see this for further information, or if you'd like an electronic copy, please let me know. Then we move on to our other system, and this is a constant flow, and you can see the system in the photo to where we can control mechanically how fast the lance moves, and then with the pump in the background, how much flow we have, the pressure, and everything else in the system. And in the right window, you can see how this is from a top view, and essentially the two probes sitting off the side are actually turbidimeters, so we can measure resuspension via those methods. And moving forward on that, one of the other systems we've developed is actually a pressurized chamber to do a continuous flow. And in this one, we can do it to about a 35% activated carbon, and does a very fine job of delivering it. But we're not doing a lot of work with the pneumatic system right now, just because of the pressure concerns. When pneumatically pressurizing this, there's a lot of energy that takes a long time to bleed off. So what we've focused on more so is a progressing cavity pump that can take a 15% slurry, and we can do plenty of flow for the systems we've got of 8 gallons per minute, and about we can get over 1,200 PSI, which is far more than we need in our system. And moving forward, you can see some of the shots that we have that are based on one lance. So these are not the cross flow, but a single nozzle where we've injected into kaolinite and into a sand. So that shows a consolidated sediment. You can see the photo on the left and on the right. And on the right, you can see an outline of this. So we get good penetration, but we're not getting the mixing we desire with the single lance system under continuous flow. And as we go forward from here, I just wanted to convey that the single lance injection system works very well for the pulsed systems, but the dual nozzle crossing jets are far better for the continuous flow. So we'll move forward there, and you can see one of the dual nozzle injections into our surrogate sediments. On the left, you see two injections, each with two nozzles, on a cross-section within the kaolinite clay. And in the right upper window, you see the dispersion of the carbon into the non-cohesive sediment, our very fine silica sand. And within that one, you can see the adjustments at the left. That one actually had a 20% carbon slurry, and the pressure we needed was only 175 PSI on a consistent basis. The diameter at depth, the diameter of the nozzles are given there. It had a 15% fan jet, and they were crossing, and the diameter of them was 15/1000th of an inch in the injection. We injected up to 30 centimeters with depth, and the width at depth was about 18 centimeters. So we'd really like to maximize that width at depth to 18 centimeters while minimizing the neck depth where we get lower impact at the surface. But under this case, we really need to impact far less than about 20% of the surface to cover the entire area at depth down to about 30 centimeters in this case. And also draw attention down to the bottom left. You can see the placement of the carbon in the kaolinite clay, and the little circles at the bottom are essentially our standards. So we mix up a known percentage of clay, and when we do our optic analysis, we look at the coloration of those versus the coloration in the clay, and then we can map out where the where the carbon is placed and what concentrations are placed at the various locations. Moving forward, so the next slide, it doesn't seem like one of the pictures translated very well. We also did some work with a capping, and you can see at the left, some of the clay was layered on top of the sand cap, but we're working on methods to actually pass these over sand-capped sediments and then inject through the sand and into the subsurface. And we do get some deposition of the contaminated, or in this case, surrogate sediments on top of the cap, but in general, the cap stays intact. So now moving on, I'll show a little bit more detail with the in-situ placement and kind of describe how we're quantifying the depth we have. So in the injection that you see there, that was a dual nozzle injection, and again, trying to get spread at depth without doing too much disturbance to the benthic layer above that minimizes resuspension and minimizes benthic impacts. And you can see essentially how we get placement at depth. So this is showing in-situ placement as the title. If you move to the next slide, you're going to use up all your red band on your monitor today. But essentially, we've converted the concentration profiles to very distinct coloration. So it's a MATLAB essentially routine that goes through pixel by pixel and lets us really see the differentiation and get down to the true concentration differences in there. So in this case, we see some of the area is above where we really want to be at the 5 or 10% level, but we also see a concentration target where we're really shooting for at about 2 to 1.5% within that range. Now move on to the next image, and this one's actually showing a pixel by pixel evaluation when we move out. So within each of the colored blocks, the red, the green, and the yellow, we get an average concentration of the carbon within that. And if we move to the next one, then we can essentially map out the carbon distribution, and the red showing at 2.5 centimeters, basically, from the center point up 7.5. And what we really want to get to is an average carbon concentration of about 2 to 5%, and as wide as possible with every injection. And this allows us to go to a manifold type of process. And if we look at the yellow one as being, we're still getting an average concentration that's well above where we really need to be, we can space our manifolds out at 12 or 15 centimeters per and then go with a continuous flow and cover the sediment and get injection then to depth. And again, the depth in this, we're reaching about 30 centimeters with depth where we were spreading out with our contaminant, our powdered activated carbon placement. And we're working on models that we can not have to do this for every site to dial in on what we want to do, but essentially using the water jet parameters, as you see on the image, and this one says hydraulic schematic for our modeling. Then we can also look at the density of the material and the stream bed information and actually project, before we go to a site, what type of essentially which nozzles to use, which pressures we need to use from very standard properties. And moving to the next one, which shows the hydraulic modeling analysis using energy and momentum equations, we're hoping to project out, again, the placement pretty well. And what we need then is to measure the sediment shear strength, compressive strength, density, and then variations with stratigraphy that allow us to project out how deep and how broadly we'll be able to apply. So we're setting up a variety of different sediments with these various properties and then injecting into them and then monitoring how well our placement projections match the actual placement in situ. And with that, I'll move on to some of our actual studies with contaminated sediments. So this one's the title of this slide, which is number 27 out of the slides I have submitted, it says bioavailability impacts at the top. And essentially, this is to evaluate where the carbon is placed in actual contaminated sediments, and we're using measurements using a solid phase microextraction method. It's a PDMS-coated fiber optic cable, essentially. It's been custom-made for this work. And what this allows us to do then is to place the steamy fiber at depth before and after the carbon placement, and we can measure the bioavailability of the compounds in place. It takes about 7 days to equilibrate. And moving through this, if you have the PowerPoint version, you can click again, and you can see a kind of an animation that then zooms in. So in the upper window, it's at a 1 meter interval, and then when we get to the second window, it's actually showing a 1 centimeter that shows our sampling tube that can be used in actual in situ for a contaminated site. And we place that at depth, and then the fiber that you can barely see in that inset is then blown up to the bottom, where we've got a 100 micron glass core with a 30 micron PDMS coating. And the PDMS basically is silicone, acts about like a benthic organism would to accumulate the compound from the surrounding pore water that should be in equilibrium with the contaminant sediments. So this allows us to do a stratified measurement very quickly and mimic the in-situ concentrations or bioavailability without having to pull a core into extraction. So there's no solvent extraction of the sediment at all in what we'll be showing for data. And moving forward, it just gives a better schematic of how this happens in situ, showing the sampling port, or a sampling lamp, is what we call it, going with depth. And the steamy fibers we're using can be up to about 2 to 3 feet long. And I give a minute for people to read through that a little bit. And then as we sample that, the fiber is extracted from the sampling port or sampling lamp. We segment it into 1 centimeter sections. Do a solvent extraction, then chemical analysis using a high-pressure liquid chromatography, or HPLC, and that allows us to measure the activated carbon. The next slide, titled Target PAC Concentrations, lets us look at some standards where we mixed up the contaminated sediment that we were using, which is an aged actual field contaminated sediment, and then we look at the drop in bioavailability with the activated carbon addition. And a lot of the earlier work, there was really great work done by Upal Ghosh and Dick Luthy, did a lot of pioneering work on looking at different carbon amendments to drop the bioavailability of contaminated sediments. And within this one, we can see that we're getting, since it's a log scale, essentially over 90% reduction with 1% carbon and about 99%+ reduction with up to 3% carbon. So, really, we don't need to add a lot of activated carbon to these systems to drop the bioavailability orders of magnitude. And moving forward, it looks at the steamy measurements for equilibration time. So after we add the steamy fiber, how long do we really need to let it sit? And it's very important that we understand that the steamy fibers are actually representative in this case. And the standard deviation we get is considerable, as with any analysis within sediment. But you can see within 2 to 5 days, we're starting to reach equilibrium, and then by 7 days, we've essentially reached equilibrium for our compounds of interest. And again, this just confirms that when we're putting the steamy fiber into the sediments, we are measuring the bioavailability of the compounds. And moving on just a little bit further, it kind of shows another one where we're, again, relating our percent activated carbon needs to our percent reduction. And you can see in this case that by the time we've added 3% carbon, our percent reduction is essentially indistinguishable from 100% removal. And the chromatography or chromatographs at the bottom show the additions then from the unamended sediment going up to 0.5% up to 3% activated carbon. And again, by the time we're at 3% activated carbon, we're essentially a non-detect as far as the bioavailability fraction goes. So this confirms that the activated carbon does drop bioavailability, and that the steamy fiber method allows us to look at different layers within one analysis and come up with what the bioavailability is, again, before and after activated carbon addition with the water jets. And moving on to the next one, this shows really some of the first data we got on injecting activated carbon into the actual contaminated sediment. And you can see the target compounds we're looking at, usually phenanthrene, pyrene, and benzoylpyrene, as our benzoylanthrene in this case, as our target compounds. We do have many other quantifications, but to convey the information, we usually focus on two or three of the most prevalent PAH compounds. And in this case, we were looking at pulse injection, and we were looking at from the center of the injection out how much we had for removal. So when you see the 3.8 and 7.6 centimeters, we just wanted to confirm that we weren't just having a localized effect overall within the system. And moving on then, we can see the depth profile within this. And so essentially moving from left to right, and the title of this slide is Pulsed Water Jet Injection Experiment. So this was, again, a pulse experiment, 7 seconds per injection, exact same setup as you saw in the earlier slide that was just on carbon placement, but this was into a true contaminated sediment. And you can see that as we move out, going from the blue to red to green, we do see less impact outside of the injection area, which is fully what we'd expect, but we are seeing an impact as the carbon has essentially mixed beyond where we placed it. And since it's pore water, we're also seeing a drop in bioavailability in areas that are truly not amended in this case. And this really conveys the idea that we don't have to amend, you know, 100% consistent distribution within it. If we let the bioavailability essentially equilibrate over time, we are seeing impacts even though we don't have perfect mixing. But we do have much better mixing in the actual sediment than in the kaolinite clay. And I'd also draw attention to, this is where we're showing an impact at 30 centimeters depth. So we've injected this into a very tight clay sediment, and a contaminated sediment that's largely clay particles and silt, and we can easily reach 30 centimeters and have greater than 90% bioavailability decrease. And at this point, I think it's also good to point out, we've never touched the sediment with any of our equipment. So the water jet essentially hovers over the top of the sediment, so if there are essentially debris or such, we're not impacting that, and we have no essentially damage to our system. Moving on to the next one, one of our lead objectives is that we don't have excessive damage to the benthic community. So we've tested acute damage to muscles, which essentially are we breaking up the shells if we pass directly over them. And you can see in the bottom right image there, essentially an intact muscle shell placed on a foam pad, essentially, so we can see how that impacts that. And we've done also some penetration impacts to look at other parameters within our jetting, how much of a fan do we have on it, what the pressure is. And using a styrene pad, a dense polystyrene, we're using that as a surrogate to see how deep we cut into that. And I don't have a lot of results on that today. I didn't think that was the focus, but the paper noted at the bottom there by Grace Harper really looked at a lot of those aspects. What I want to focus on today is moving on to the next one, is the direct impacts to invertebrates. So we did a couple different of the organisms, the Azteca and the Tentans organism, and essentially there are two different types. One is more of a water flea. The other one is essentially a type of a benthic worm. And we passed the water jet at a much higher pressure to see what our maximum impact would be over a sediment bed that had been inoculated with these organisms and that were, you know, I'd like to say as happy as a clam, but they're benthic organisms that were doing quite well in the setting. And then we disrupted it by passing the water jet over as if we were going through and doing a continuous flow pass at the injection. And then we took the organisms, essentially remove them from the system, and then look for recovery, but also viability to see if they survive the system. And moving on to the next slide, which shows two tables and a picture of the organism. And the data here is shown for the Azteca and the Tentans, the how many were recovered and how many were in the sand or in the water column. And then the green is the alive and D is the dead. And we also had some that would come in at non-recovered. So in the upper image, we started out with 30 organisms in one and 20 in another, And then directly after injection, out of the 30 in the first one, we recovered 21 alive in the water column and 6 alive in the sand. So in that case, we had 27 out of the 30 survive, and they actually survived over time. And then the second one, when we had 20 alive organisms to start out with, you can see we recovered 19, and then over time, we actually had 14 make it. So in this case, we're still getting 90 or 70% survival after direct injection to the sediment where they were living initially. And then you see the tendons, which is a little bit more of a worm in the system. And after we injected those, you see two studies that were done with 20 organisms and with 10. And we essentially had 11 survival in the first setting, and we had 10 survive in the second setting with no mortality in that case. So this just really conveys that as we do this remediation approach or bioavailability reduction approach with the water jets, we're not obliterating the community that we're trying to protect in the first place. So we're dropping the bioavailability. We can certainly measure that. And we're leaving behind a viable community in the benthic community, that we're not, again, obliterating that through our remediation. I think that's important as we look forward to trying to improve the quality of these sites, that at this point we don't have to go back in and try to restore a benthic population or a benthic setting for survival of the organisms. We leave it intact for the most part. So moving on to our next slide, which I realize I've gone a little bit faster here than I'd expect, but that'll leave a lot of time for questions. Without question, we can deliver the amendment. And while there are certainly challenges that we have to overcome at each site, we can look very positively at trying to place them. Overall, we're looking probably at a powdered activated carbon slurry in about the 15% range up to about 20. With the pneumatic systems, we can go higher with that. And the real benefit of that is the more dense our solution is, the less carrier water we have that essentially is displacing perhaps the contaminated pore water sediments, and also minimizing the energy we have to deliver, and thereby limiting the resuspension aspects and also the benthic impacts. When we look at a consolidated sediment, such as the clay, the short pulse injection seemed to do very well. So a manifold spaced at 1 or 2 inches apart could easily deliver the required activated carbon to a depth of 20 centimeters. And we really haven't pushed that a lot farther to see how much deeper we could go. But we certainly know we can go up to 30 without pushing our system really hard. The dual nozzle system, which would allow for much faster injection, works very well for the non-cohesive sediments, a little bit sandier or fewer particle-particle interactions, a little bit lower shear strength of the sediment. And we have a very low disturbance ratio with that. We're only impacting about 5% of the surface to remediate the sediment at depth. Resuspension was substantial in this, and that really limits our pneumatic amendment approach because of the additional energy that brings to it. So we're looking at if resuspension is a considerable concern at the sites, if the surface sediment is really contaminated. The pneumatic amendment feed, which was going back to some of the first slides here, very effective at delivering the zero-valent iron. It really doesn't seem like that's going to be an approach where we're headed towards. And then the benthic organisms in the benthic community was pretty minimal, even when we went up to some of our highest pressures, up to about 1,400 PSI, and less than 20% mortality overall. And I think that conveys well that, and certainly if we put these water jets over at a few hundred PSI, these invertebrates are essentially in trouble if they touch them. But what it comes down to is that less than 15% of the surface has to be amended within these cases. So what we touch, we're probably going to cut apart pretty well, but since we don't need to touch the entire surface to deposit the activated carbon at depth effectively, that minimizes the benthic impacts. And one thing we haven't tested there at the bottom is we have a lot of the carbon that gets resuspended in solution as we inject it, along with what's sediment we resuspend. So our hypothesis is that as that sediment is redeposited, it's deposited with the activated carbon as well, and that any resuspension, even in the water column, has a limited bioavailability impact. And following this up to the acknowledgement slide, again, Heather Henry and the gang at NIEHS has been very helpful and supportive. Obviously, providing the funding is the biggest part, but they've been great at providing opportunities for us to work with other people and to do a presentation such as today or when we were at the NARPA meetings the last couple of years. And we've got a whole slew of people. I don't hit them all here, but especially Gary Abbott, Steve Gable, and Scott Parker have been very instrumental in developing the mechanical systems that we need to carry out this work. And then you see Nathan, Jack, Matt, and John have done a lot of work on the systems, but also the analytic methods that we use. Matt and John have been really helpful in pulling together the STEAMI work. So with that, I go to our questions slide, which I give my contact information, Birkin@mst.edu, and also for Kurt Elmore, again, who's the co-PI and really deserves any equal credit possible on doing this work. He's been phenomenal to work with, and really a joy to bring together a large team on this one. It's been an enjoyable project to see it go well to this point. And with that, I think I went a little faster than I'd expected or others, but I'd be happy to answer questions for as long as necessary.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Joel. With that, I'm going to remind those of you who are on the phone lines that you will be able to take yourself off of mute at this point and go ahead and ask a question or comment directly. But before I let you do that, I do have some questions that were submitted electronically, and I want to encourage those of you who are streaming the audio, if you haven't done so already, go ahead and click that question mark button to open up a new window to type up your comment or question, and then I'll read those out loud on your behalf so that you can get an answer from our instructor. So if you're streaming the audio, be sure to click that question mark button to type up your question or comment, and then in a few moments, I'll start reading those. But while we have additional questions like that being typed up and coming in, I'm going to start with the telephone line participants. So if you're on the phone lines and you'd like to ask a question, please feel free to take yourself off of mute. You can either use your own mute button to unmute, or if you use our commands, it's #6 to unmute your line. So you want to hit #6 and then identify either yourself or your organization. I think I heard somebody hit the keys. Is there a question?
No.
Nope. Okay, just making sure.
I have a question.
Go right ahead.
I was wondering, with this research, whether you've been able to come up with some kind of a ratio as to what the spacing would need to be with multiple injectors, you know, for a field application, mm-hmm. in terms of being able to, you know, mass produce this kind of an effort for injecting, you know, say a site area.
Yes, and on the specific spacing within that gets into, I think there are a couple slides that show the distribution at depth. And then the optic methods that look at spacing up to 12 or 15 centimeters. And with the current sediments we've been working with, we're looking at about a 15 centimeter or about a 6-inch spacing for the individual injectors. And the idea there is that we get full coverage below the surface. What we've not been able to do is see what the interactions are between those heads then. And we expect that we could actually go to a wider spacing when we have a manifold injecting, because we'll have each of the jets interacting. So essentially they'll cross over at depth, and the sediment won't hold together between the two, like, 15-centimeter spacing. So to answer your question shortly there in summary, no, we have not scaled up to any field site, but that is directly related to what we've done so far, and we're looking at probably like a 15-centimeter or a half a foot spacing on individual injectors. That would be then, you know, manifolded together to one supply.
Okay.
Okay, great. Again, if we have another phone participant who has a question or would like to make a comment, by all means, you're welcome to take yourself off of mute using either your own mute button, if you use those locally on your phone, or hitting *6 and then identifying either yourself or organization. We do have about 120 people, actually, believe it or not, Joel, from all over the world joining us. We even have individuals signing in from France to listen in to your talk today.
Great.
So I just wanted to be sure everybody feels welcome. And if we don't hear anybody on the phone lines right now, I'm going to start reading some of the questions that have been submitted electronically. Again, I will switch back to the phone lines in a few moments, so if you do have a question, go ahead and hang tight. We'll get back to the phone lines. For those of you streaming the audio, you can continue to click the question mark button to have a new window pop up so you can ask the question or type it in and I'll ask it on your behalf. The first question that actually came in from Deerfield, Illinois is a question regarding certificates or CEUs, and I will answer that at the end of the presentation today. We'll provide information on how you can get records or information to help you apply for CEUs. So bear with us until we get to the closeout of the materials today and we'll go over that. But the first question that's related to our presentation today is coming in from Knoxville, Tennessee, and they asked what particle size of silica sand was used in the, quote, movie demo of injection in the lab. Was it small enough to be resuspended in your lab demo?
It was small enough to be resuspended, but they'll settle very quickly. I want to say they're at a, I can't remember the exact mesh size, but about 100 micron. So they will, quote, unquote, resuspend, but given the, that it's the sand with the very highest density, it'll settle out very quickly. And the clay, I think you may have seen from that, that our evaluation of resuspension in our current setup is really not very accurate because we have such a small water column. So we actually have ongoing studies now with a larger water-to-sediment ratio as far as our flume goes, and actually we're going through different flow velocities and seeing how far downstream the resuspension occurs. And we certainly think that'll be, you know, directly related to the settling velocities and how quickly they settle out of solution for those. So essentially the clay particles will stay in suspension longer and further downstream. But the sand used there, we had very little resuspension.
Okay, great. The next question is also coming in from Knoxville, Tennessee. And they state, your estimate of effectiveness in real sediment based on the log, parentheses, peak area versus percent AC plot can only be true if conditions in the real world sediment are equivalent to those that come up with the plot. Is that correct?
Oh, certainly. And we'd want to look at, we're doing some studies looking at different activated carbon doses needed for different sediments. And that will range. I mean, there's no question about it that if you have a higher organic content sediment, it's going to have a higher contaminant load for the same pore water. So in that type of case, we would expect to see a smaller impact of this because the compounds are already at a low chemical activity, and there must be a, you know, tremendous concentration if we see a pore water concentration that's high. So to summarize that quickly, the more organic nature the sediment is, we probably would require a higher concentration to drop that bioavailability because there's already competition for the contaminants, so we'd have to introduce more in that case. But those are also the cases where we see low pore water and low bioavailability already. I hope that makes sense, that it will vary given how hydrophobic, or excuse me, how organic nature the sediment is and the partitioning coefficients already.
Okay. The next question, do you have more response?
Oh, I was just going to say, but this is a fairly high organic content sediment, so I think these are perhaps even conservative for what we're doing. Our the organic carbon in this sediment was about 3 or 4%. So there's already a lot of carbon there, and it's got a very high total concentration of contaminants, and it's been aged for quite a while.
Okay. The next question comes in from Indonesia, and they're asking, in reality, sediment is always moving. So how, and I'm not sure if the statement is how the tools overcome with that reality. So I don't know if they're asking you, if sediment's always moving, you know, how does your tool get past that?
Yeah, and that's certainly true. I mean, a sediment load, if it's, you know, contaminated, it came from somewhere, so unless it's right at the discharge point, you know, it's not under a quiescent or stable condition. It has moved and probably will move some more. And overall, the concept that we really haven't developed. And again, the adding the carbon, that's not our idea or our fundamental work here. It's the delivery mechanism for. But the concept is that if we add the activated carbon, it lowers the availability or the specific chemical activity of the contaminants. So while they are still there and they have not been changed, they're not available to enter into the benthic organisms, into the food chain, into the water column, so thereby mitigating the risk, not destroying the contaminant. And if that holds true, which we've, you know, to my knowledge, there hasn't been any field studies that have put in the activated carbon through any methods for a large scale and then monitored with time, but if that chemical activity of the system is reduced, even if the sediment moves, it still should stay reduced. So the activated carbon then takes up the contaminant load instead of allowing it to transfer into, again, the water column or the benthic organisms.
Okay. The next question is just a general question that came in anonymously from the audience, and they're asking if you have any future research planned or if you have any expectations of being able to do site or field-based demonstrations of this approach.
That's a great question, and yes, I do have future research plans, or else I'd probably be out of a job to answer it shortly. our next level is we are looking to scale this up into field applicable scale, so essentially a pilot run at an actual contaminated site. And within that, we are looking for essentially collaborators. We're, you know, at a university. We've worked some with the Army Corps and some other groups, but we're looking at a potential site that would be open to essentially remedial technology development. We're certainly at that stage, and we do have needs to trial this and scale it up. With that, the water jet lab that essentially this spun out of is very good at upscaling the pump systems and the delivery, but they've never tried anything with the sediments either, so we need some field partners.
Okay. The next question that I have submitted electronically, they ask, can you envision any regulatory barriers to this approach?
Certainly, in some cases, they're looking for, you know, absolute removal of the contaminants or destruction of. So if we go back into even our activated carbon amended systems and we do a full extraction, a SOX lid or accelerated solvent extraction, we'll still pull back our contaminants. So there does need to be some regulatory acceptance to the bioavailability or the chemical activity approach, which really relates to risk, rather than an absolute extractable total concentration. But I really want to stress here, what we've done in all the slides I've shown here does not destroy the contaminant. It reduces the transferability. Now, we could, and we plan to, utilize this technology with a bioremediation approach to where we could take a slurry of organisms, pass them through the jet. Yes, they do survive in the tests we've done so far, but then look for, you know, biodegradation and total destruction of the contaminants. But even in those cases, it's going to take a long time because all of these hydrophobic compounds are not available for biodegradation either. So you're going to see the same limitation there. So from a regulatory standpoint, if it's absolute destruction or removal from the site, and that's not what we're doing at all, then you're really looking at dredging as the only approach. But if capping is an option to where you're limiting the bioavailability of the transfer, then I think we're right in tune with that same regulatory approach.
Okay, great. The next question is coming in from Boston, and it is somewhat related to this idea of regulatory or, you know, actual field demonstrations. They're asking you to describe this type of site that you would consider best suited to this particular technology. So if you were looking for your partner, what kind of site would they be bringing to you?
I don't think we want to stretch the chemical/bioavailability approach and our technical capabilities, so I wouldn't look for something that's really deep. So we're not looking to try and, you know, drop this down 200 feet into a really deep sediment or a deep area, so something where we can have access to the technology, inject it, watch the bioavailability. So probably not the busiest shipping channels in the world, and something that's fairly stable so that we know we're not measuring, you know, if we measure bioavailability drop in the future, we know it's not sediment repositioning, where it's scoured and moved downstream, so that's why we're not measuring it and been replaced. So something, and where there's a record already in place. So the contaminants have been there, they are stable, they're not dropping, so that when we measure the change that we expect, we know it is a true change from our remediation, not from outside effects. Because we're going to have very rigorous data collection at our first few sites to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt or without a lot of scientific question that what we're doing is working.
Okay.
So well characterized and accessible, I think, would be the top two.
Okay. I'm going to take a moment and see if we have any other phone questions or comments that may be coming in. Again, if you're on the phone lines, you're welcome to take yourself off of mute. You can use #6 or use your own unmute button if that's the set of commands you used earlier. Okay. I do have an additional question that came in online, and this question is asking about cost estimates or efficiency calculations for this remedial approach. They want to know if you've gotten to that point in your research. So, it's technically, you can do it technically, but what would the financial cost be for this type of an approach?
To answer that distinctly and quickly, no. But we truly need, field expertise on that. I wouldn't even begin to estimate, costs for, if this is going to be done from a barge, essentially using the same techniques as a cutter head dredging. I have no estimation whatsoever on those costs.
Okay, great.
Powdered activated carbon is fairly cheap. That's the best I can offer right now.
Excellent. And, okay, I don't see any other electronic questions that are coming in. So, and I don't hear anybody else on the phone line speaking up. So, with that, before we start the closeout comments and I give people information on how to get feedback, how to get credit for today, Joel, I just want to give you an opportunity to make any other closing statements or comments.
No, I'd just really like to, again, thank NIHS for funding this, my collaborators that were on slide 2 within this. While I'm the one who gets to speak on the phone today, it's my students and colleagues that end up getting all black from the activated carbon and up to their knees in sediments on a regular basis. So they deserve a lot of the credit for this. And thanks to the Kluin group and Jody, Jean, and Rob for helping to set this up. It's a great opportunity.
Great. And before we let you go, I did manage to have one more question sneak in online. And this is a little bit, I think you'll ask there, we need more clarification on the entire approach, because this is a question from Indonesia, and they're basically saying, well, if this tool didn't destroy the contaminant, that technically means that the sediment itself is still not safe.
And that is a good question, and that's to the regulatory question of what is safe. And some of the work that Upal Ghosh has done, some really nice work, he's out of University of Maryland, Baltimore College, and they have added the amendment mechanically, so we're basically proposing that we've got a better method of, or a different method of delivering the amendments. I wouldn't say better in all cases, and certainly if it's a surface contaminant, their work at a surface application is excellent. But when it's mixed into sediments, they've taken actual sediments, mixed in the carbon, and then exposed unamended and amended to a variety of organisms that are essentially caged. So they can see, recover the exact organisms. They're not looking at, do organisms move in or out. And then looking at the whole body load, so essentially extracting the organisms and seeing what the contaminant uptake has been in the organism, and looking at survivability and mortality issues. And their work is very conclusive that when we drop the bioavailability or the chemical activity, we see much lower concentrations in the biota. So if the regulatory question is it safe, and it's proven from, sediment toxicity studies, yeah, this does make the contaminant or sediment safe from survivability and essentially biologic burden from the sediment. But that is the regulatory question that remains, is are we looking to make the site essentially non-toxic and reduce the risk, or are we looking at eliminating the contaminants, which in a lot of cases eliminates the benthic community and also eliminates the sediments overall. So if we're dredging these out and removing them, we're transferring it to another site intact, be it a surface disposal or a confinement, sediment confinement system. So that really comes to the regulatory question of what is safe.
Excellent. And we did have another question come in online, since we still have some time left.
Great.
If you'll take it, this one's coming in from New York. And they are asking, would you consider working together with similar patented technology that has a vessel that hovers over the sediment and then contains the suspended material while working with the sediments?
I didn't follow that. So there's an underwater containment vessel?
Yeah, so it's described as a patented technology that has a vessel that hovers over the sediment and contains the suspended materials while working in the sediments.
Oh yeah, certainly. We actually, in our, work had proposed that when this goes to a field scale, the makeup water that mixes with the, activated carbon, has essentially slurried together so that we essentially removed some of the suspended water and sediment and then mix that back with the carbon for reinjection, because we need makeup water to consistently make the slurry and reinject it. That sounds very similar, so I think that would be a very viable approach. And one other approach we've looked at is if this is set for a dredging at a future date, you could go in and preemptively add the activated carbon, reduce the water burden and the bioavailability, so then as the site is dredged, we don't see the resuspension of available contaminants. So essentially, sequester the contaminants, and then if it's dredged, as it's dredged, it would dredge the carbon and the sediment, and it would be hopefully in a non-toxic form. So there's other applications once we get to field scale.
Okay. And what I'll also do is suggest to the individual that asked that question, you're certainly welcome to contact Joel directly if you want to kind of pursue the avenue of working together. His contact information is listed on the second to last slide, and you'll also find it on the seminar homepage. So if you want to make that connection to work together in the future, go ahead and reach out to him directly. I also had another question that came in online, and this question is asking, what kind of powdered activated carbon did you use? And then they also go on to ask, what estimates of exhaustion rates would you expect?
Exhaustion rates we haven't checked yet, but I don't think we're going to be pushing those at all, because the level of bioavailability in the sediment is not that high to start with. So I don't think we'd exhaust that. I really can't tell you offhand what the manufacturer is, but there's so many manufacturers of activated carbon. We do have all the size distribution measurements, and I can forward that to somebody individually, but looking at what average size of particle it is, we're definitely in the micro scale, sub low microns to below, but it's not nanoparticles or anything along those scale. So, sorry, I don't have a better detailed information at my disposal here.
Nope, that's okay. And since we did have some additional questions come in there, I want to quickly check and make sure that there aren't any other ones on the phone.
And I will back up 1 second and say this was, it was just a standard commercially available activated carbon. We didn't look for anything special or in particular, so we just bought a super sack and we've been working out of that.
Okay. Again, if you're on the phone lines, you have any other questions or comments, you can unmute using your own mute button or hitting #6. Okay, don't hear anybody on the phone lines, and I don't see anything else coming in online. And we've had your chance to make your closing comments to everyone. So with that, I'm going to ask everyone to move on to the final slide that was available from the CLUIN website, which would be slide number 43, which is our resources and feedback slide. On that slide, there are two links, the first one being the additional resources page, where you can download today's PowerPoint presentation and also take a look at some other resources that were collected relative to our presentation today. Joel, if you have other things that you think would be relevant, links to papers or other research opportunities related to this project, we can include them on that resources page. You just need to share it with either myself or Jody. But I would encourage people to take a look at that resources page. The other link that you'll find on slide number 43 is our feedback form. It's a very short form just letting us know what you thought of today's session. And if you are looking to receive credit for today's participation, although we don't issue CEUs or PDHs directly, what you can do is actually fill out that feedback form and check a box to have a confirmation email sent to you for your records, which will at least verify that you submitted feedback for the session from a certain location at a certain time. And usually what our participants are able to do, if they collect that along with a printout of the slides and a copy of their registration email, they can submit that and then get credit for participating from whatever institution or organization is requiring the CEUs or PDHs. So again, if you're looking for credit or confirmation, the best we can do is give you that confirmation email after you submit feedback. If you shared the line with multiple participants, after someone submits feedback, there'll be a link that will appear that will allow the next person or someone else to hop on that computer, fill out their own feedback form, and get their own confirmation sent to them for their records. The other thing to know is that both of those links, if you're just looking at a printout of the slides, are actually available on the seminar homepage. So if you're not actively looking at the internet right now, you can certainly go back to the seminar homepage whenever you like and follow the links that appear on the left as well as the bottom of the page, again, to the resources or links and then the feedback form. And please know that I do read each and every one of the responses that go up there. So if you'd like to continue to see free technical training like this offered for through Cluin, we would ask you to take a moment to fill out that form to make sure we can continue to deliver a valuable service. And I still don't see any more online comments, so I think we captured everything. So with that, I just want to extend my thanks to the NARPM organizers who put together and actually coordinated getting the NARPM Presents series on Cluin. And I also want to thank Joel from our speaker today who came to us again, from the Missouri University of Science and Technology. I want to thank him for taking the time to give this presentation, answering your questions, and sharing his information. And I also want to extend our gratitude to the over 120 different participants we had from actually all over the world today who joined us for today's seminar. I hope that you guys found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that we'll continue to have you participate on future Cluin seminars. So with that, this is our formal conclusion of today's presentation. You will receive an automatic email as soon as the archive is available for free replay and download, so you want to keep your eyes peeled for that in about 1 to 2 weeks. Again, thank you all for joining us, and I hope you guys have a great rest of your day.